Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Bill Finger. I'm appearing on behalf of Ms. Kirkmeyer. I'm not going to lay out the factual basis. The court is well familiar with the factual basis. The position that we have is that the remand, we believe, required an interpretation or an implementation of the safe harbor provision with its mandatory language. The ALJ and through the board then refused to interpret or apply the mandatory language, and specifically found that that was not an issue she was going to determine, where the board was going to determine. That was for some court, you, the district court, somebody else to interpret. What the ALJ did also is not address even the issue of waiver, which is a critical issue concerning employees' rights under the State Personnel Board, including rights in reinstatement. What rights were waived, what rights weren't. And the issue becomes then, what the ALJ did is merely look at the remand as, what are we doing under the board rules for getting the safe harbor provision? Because the board rules said my client would have reinstatement rights regardless, totally neglecting what the safe harbor language was.
Well, isn't that at least one interpretation of Judge Graham's opinion, which is that all the safe harbor clause gives you is reinstatement rights?
We think the opinion is more than that, because otherwise the safe harbor language is meaningless. You wouldn't need the safe harbor language if that was the interpretation, because that's under the board rule. So the safe harbor language has to mean something. And the testimony adduced at hearing is the safe harbor language was a guarantee to return. In other words, what the safe harbor language did is waive the discretion of the appointing authority not to reinstate if there was a vacant position. And our interpretation was what the Court of Appeals said in Kirkmeyer 1 is that if we could demonstrate there was a vacant position for which my client qualified, then the executive director's discretion not to reinstate had been waived, had been given up, that there was a right to a position if there was a vacant position, and my client had not waived that requirement in entering the agreement. She wouldn't have entered the agreement but for that protection.
Mr. Finger, if I can back you up for a second, excuse me for interrupting you. I'm still having trouble really follow up on Judge Webb's question. It seems to me that you're really arguing that Judge Graham got it wrong. And Kirkmeyer won. The argument you just made that the safe harbor clause must mean something more than reinstatement only, because that's what the rules get. I understand the argument you're making, but Judge Graham did say that to save the safe harbor clause and be consistent with the statute, it has to be read to mean that you have a right to reinstatement with no guarantee of a particular position. And so, maybe I'm just not fully understanding the argument you're making, but it seems like reinstatement and no right to guarantee is precisely what Kirkmeyer held. And so if that's, I understand if you want to argue that's wrong, and let's have that discussion. But if that's right, it seems to me that that's what the board applied. So maybe you can address that. Yeah. If I'm missing you, I apologize.
I don't think that's exactly what Judge Graham said. I think he left it somewhat up in the air. I think what Judge Graham was clear about in his opinion was that the return to some position had to be a vacant position. We weren't going to exercise bumping rights, displacing someone in a position. So if there was a vacant position, this is what I believe the decision stands for, that if there was a vacant position for which my client would qualify, there would be reinstatement.
Okay, but it seems to me there's three levels that your client could have rights. One is bumping, I get to throw somebody out.
Yes.
The middle one is what you just articulated. If it's open and I was previously certified to it, it's mine for the asking. And the third one is you're just like everybody else. If there's an open position, you get to apply for it, and there's appointing authority discretion. I mean, do you agree those are essentially the three possible choices?
No.
Okay.
I don't agree. Okay. Because the testimony from the director of personnel, which was introduced through deposition, clearly established that the safe harbor language was the second position, or the
yours for the asking if you're called.
Yeah. I mean, that was what it was intended to by the director of personnel. That's what Ms. Kirkmeyer understood what it meant.
Okay, I understand.
And therefore, we believe it's number two, if not number the first one, where it's...
Well, you've given up the first one. You've given up.
We didn't argue the first one. We were willing to accept that she wasn't going to displace anyone.
Okay, what is it in Judge Graham's opinion gets you to number two?
Because the argument that was presented effectively to the court was that the safe harbor language was void. And if it were void, didn't mean anything. That's what they argued. It didn't mean anything. And if it has meaning, it's got to be something more than this third option you're talking about. It's got to be option two. Otherwise, it wouldn't have meaning.
The argument essentially is that Judge Graham probably did not base his remand order on that view of the contract, because that view of the contract would be incorrect, and we should presume that Judge Graham did something reasonable with that language.
Well, I think you have to... That's my argument.
Okay.
You have to integrate what his thinking was with the personnel board rules. It's got to mean something more. Otherwise, it's meaningless. That was a term that was specifically negotiated. Executive directors, with the concurrence of the governor's office, were given discretion to add this provision as an additional protection.
You're saying that what I characterize as option three, she'd have if there was no safe harbor clause.
That's right.
Okay, so we have to read Graham's opinion as breathing some level of life into the safe harbor clause.
Safe harbor clause. Otherwise, there's nothing there. It's got to be an integrated interpretation.
But isn't that interpretation possibly motivated by what everybody agrees is a factual misapprehension about her being in or out of the classified system? The previous opinion seems to be based on the view that while she was an SES on that pay scale, she was not a member of the classified system.
That opinion, I would speculate to say what was going on in Judge Graham's mind. What was before Judge Graham in the court was this was a hybrid system. This was something sort of concocted that is not consistent with the constitutional principles, as we've argued. And as a hybrid system, he may have confused being within the traditional classified pay system and the SES pay system, because it is a pay system differential.
Pay plan, right?
It's a pay plan. It's a play plan. It's very clear that it's a pay plan. And the other reason why they got it wrong, Your Honors, is because for my client to give up those rights, there has to be a knowing and voluntary waiver of my client's rights, which she clearly didn't do.
Counsel, now let's go back, because I understand this one argument that you've made now that will enable us to help, you know, help us determine what actually got decided and what is the scope of the remand order. My question now is, do you have anything else? Is there anything else in that opinion that that supports your view about that would that you are?
Sure. Okay. Judge Graham also mentions that in his opinion that the board never considered the waiver offer issue. And again, the board never considered the waiver issue in this proceeding, expressly excluding it. And even if it was considered, the agency never met the burden of proof of showing waiver.
And your argument would be that by reserving judgment about that waiver issue, that implies that there's something more to this contract interpretation than meets the eye. Because if it's interpreted as the government interprets it, then there's nothing to waive.
That's right. So I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Certainly.
Thank you, Your Honors. Vincent Borscher, First Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Department of Local Affairs. I think the ALJ got it right. I think she interpreted exactly what Judge Graham said. And the big elephant in the room that's being ignored here in counsel's argument and that Judge Graham addressed is Section 2450.104.5C, which specifically says you shall have no right to a position. When he issued his opinion, he said the way to harmonize, you have to harmonize it in looking at that statute and that mandated by the legislature that you shall have no right to a position with this term that says that you shall go back into a position. And I think the way he harmonized it, the way he instructed the board to look at it, and I think they properly did look at it, is by saying that if she does compete for a position, if she is able to get that position, then the term provides what the salary will be, whether it be at the top of the range or at the same salary.
Could you respond to, as I understood Mr. Finger's argument, he's saying that Judge Graham had to mean more than that. Judge Graham and his colleagues on the division had to mean more than that, because if it only meant that you have the reinstatement rights, then the safe harbor clause didn't mean anything because you already had those rights under the board rules. I heard what you just said, but would you respond to that argument?
Well, I think if Judge Graham meant to say it would have been said in the opinion. I think the reading was based on a narrow record on a dismissal, and the intent of the Court of Appeals to, under the Salas case, which I agree is proper, that when there is a question about whether they get a hearing at the board, you're going to err on the side of giving a hearing. So I think in looking at that, he decided that we're going to harmonize these and give a hearing on that. And it's not that he gives any additional importance to the term, saying you have these additional rights or anything, but just creating a way to say, State Personnel Board, you need to give a hearing. The issue I want you to look at is whether or not she can compete. Certainly these rights are there. I mean, the rights are in the contract itself and the rule. You know, it's the contract language sort of, you know, it says one thing here, and then at the end it has this contested provision that gives this whole different thing. And I think the judge was just trying to harmonize that so that there would be a good basis for the personnel board to have a hearing on this and give her a chance to have her day in court with the board to argue, you know, why she should be able to compete. And additionally, the ALJ threw in the discrimination issue, and so that was something else that the board gave her.
But what did the safe harbor clause give Ms. Kirkmeyer that the rules didn't already, in your view?
I think it's the salary part. I think he mentioned that if she does compete, she is allowed to be placed in a position where she's at the top of the range or the current salary she had, whichever is lower. I believe that's the language. Judge Graham mentioned that. And so I believe that was the extent of it. The opinion acknowledges that she had no right to a job. In looking at that provision, he said she shall have no right to a job. The question is, does she have a right to compete? I mean, I absolutely she has a right to compete, just like anyone else. The difference is she's previously certified in various classes, so in her competition, she wouldn't have to test for it. She could just move right in and be on a list and be chosen.
But let me stop here. I mean, I may be just repeating Judge Gabriel's question, but if what you say is the Graham interpretation of the SHC, then it seems to me Mr. Finger is correct that she isn't granted any rights beyond what she would have as a certified employee anyway.
Well, the department's position is that the provision is illegal because of the statute anyway. And so I think it was avoiding an interpretation based on a slim record to say it's illegal. But in the broad picture, I think it is illegal because it conflicts with the statute.
Well, I'm not sure that answered my question, though.
I'm sorry.
Exactly what do you read the Graham opinion as giving her under the SHC that she wouldn't have if the SHC had never been in the contract?
Well, I think there was the factual error in the decision that led to it that said that you don't have rights while you're in the contract as a classified employee. So I think because that factual error was relied on, it jumped to the step of saying that you may have a right to compete, or whether you have a right to compete, whether you are considered classified. I think that was just the factual error that led to that.
So this leads to the question then about whether we are free to disagree with the prior division's interpretation of the safe harbor clause. What's your position on that?
Well, I believe that you are free to disagree, and I would ask that you, or the department would ask that you do disagree in the fact of saying that it may be harmonized, because our position all along has been that it can't be harmonized, it should be stricken, it should be declared illegal because it conflicts with the statute that says you shall have no right, and it provides a situation that's not entitled to any other state employee. She gets a salary above 25% above the statutory cap. She gets guaranteed employment without an agency having discretion to decide whether or not she stays.
Sorry, I didn't understand the last thing you said.
Sure. The main point here is that the executive director gets to decide whether or not you're going to hire someone after the SES contract or another appointing authority. They have that discretion to decide, okay, here's our candidates, we'll select this Kirkmeyer, we'll select someone else. That's a discretion of the agency. What the safe harbor provision does is it takes that discretion completely away from any appointing authority and saying you shall be placed into a position, no ifs, ands, or buts. That conflicts with the Constitution and the appointing authority's ability to select who they want from the rule of three in the Constitution. So I think that's the main problem, and that's what Mr. Finger is arguing, that that this provision gets rid of that discretion, and I think we believe that would be a wrong interpretation to say that you can take that discretion away and tie the hands of a new appointing authority by doing so, by agreeing to this provision.
Your view would be the option, the job is yours for the asking, which I characterized as option two with Mr. Finger, is unconstitutional?
I believe that it conflicts with the statute.
Well, forget about the statute. I thought you said it was unconstitutional.
Well, yeah, to the extent that it takes the discretion away from the appointing authority, absolutely, I believe it would be unconstitutional.
And what you called the rule of pick one of three is in the Constitution?
Yes, it is, and it's the appointing authority appoints people to positions, and they decide, and it is a rule of three, and it's all in the Constitution, and that's the way the personnel system is set up, is that the appointing authority selects the people. It's unique because it's a pay plan. It's an agreement that you will get paid more than everyone else, yet you're going to waive something.
Okay, let me come back. Do you agree with Mr. Finger's statement that the SES is merely a pay plan and Ms. Kirkmeyer and all other people in it remained classified employees for all other purposes?
During the terms of the contract, yes.
Okay. And you agree then that she would remain a classified employee after the contract expired?
Well, she would remain a classified employee if she were to be hired for a position. She would have the same rights as any other prior classified employee.
I should have said that. Okay. So you agree with it, Mr. Finger, on that point. Do you also agree that there was a factual error, perhaps a significant one, in the Graham opinion that it did not recognize that she retained the rights of a prior, that she was a classified employee throughout this process?
Well, As far as calling it significant, I'm not
sure. Well, okay, but I'll back off from it. Do you agree that that was, whatever its significance may be, that was an error in the Graham opinion?
We believe that it was an error that helped support the point of harmonizing the two and giving and sending it back for a hearing. Yes. And additionally, I mean, I agree. I disagree with the opinion to the extent it says that the provision may be harmonized, may be considered. Our position all along has been that it is a legal position that should have no place in the contract.
Thank you.
Okay. There's substantial evidence, as pointed out in the answer brief, for the decision of the ALJ, the credibility determination by the ALJ that Executive Director Susan Kirkpatrick was credible is in there, and as you know, that must be affirmed on appeal.
Mr. Morrison, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I guess I'm hung up now on the procedural aspects of this. So let's take another step from what you just said. Let's hypothetically say we were to conclude here that Judge Graham, because of the factual error, the harmonization was wrong. Procedurally, what would happen next? Wouldn't we have to send this back to the board, not even get to these merits issues, and say, you know, the board, you know, hypothetically, the board applied Judge Graham's ruling correctly, but if we said Judge Graham got it wrong, it seems like the board has to take another crack at it. And it's nice that the board made all these factual findings, but it seems like they wouldn't be binding at that point. Am I correct about that?
No, I don't think you're correct. I think there was a hearing. There was a hearing on issues that were pertinent for the board, for example, the political affiliation discrimination. I don't think Judge Graham had to reach that in order to send it back for a hearing. I think alone saying that persons in the state personnel system have a right to a hearing on issues, and I believe the issue of competition for a position, it was valid to look at that.
But that may not be the exclusive issue. If Judge Graham narrowed the issue to essentially saying you have a right to reinstatement, which means you have a right to compete. That's what the ALJ and the board understood. They ruled on that basis and said Ms. Kirkmeyer had a full right to compete. If we disagree with that, so the discrimination piece may be different, and I tend to agree with that. But this first argument seems to me you need a do-over if we were to say he was wrong.
I don't know what the do-over would be on, because the factual issue, I mean, it was all addressed there, whether or not the ALJ went beyond by addressing an issue that wasn't part of opinion, relied on incorrect facts, or whether she had her day in court to talk about it. It wasn't a day in court to talk about the contract formation, the issues that the board doesn't have jurisdiction over, and that was handled in the companion case through the district court.
So why wouldn't, if and again, I'm not asking you to yield points, but if Judge Graham's interpretation is potentially wrong because of this factual error, and if, as you, I think, acknowledged a couple minutes ago, there are conflicting provisions within her third contract itself, why wouldn't the board have jurisdiction to interpret a potentially ambiguous contract?
Because of the statute that says she shall have no right to a position.
All right, well, let's put the statute aside. Is there something that I'm not aware of in terms of the board's jurisdiction that would preclude it from resolving a traditional ambiguity question in a contract between a state agency and its employee?
Yeah, and it's hard for me to set the statute aside because the rules rely on the statute.
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, there's no reason to answer my question by going back to the statute. Is there some more fundamental jurisdictional limitation in what the board and the ALJ could do if they are presented with an ambiguous contract between a state agency and its employee?
I don't, because I think it's a matter of contract law, and the board looks at if someone was terminated, any kind of disciplinary action, I'm sorry. They look at disciplinary actions, they look at grievance appeals. There's not this other area of, you know, give and take between an employee and an agency over a contract that they look at. They don't have anything laid up in their statutory authority or rules to support that. So I don't see any other issue they could have looked at here. I think...
She answered me. Are you saying that there is a statutory or constitutional limitation on the board conducting a traditional ambiguity analysis to interpret a contract between a state employee, a state agency and its employee?
Yes.
Okay, and what is the statutory or constitutional prohibition against doing that?
Let me back up. There's not a prohibition, but there's no authority. There's no constitutional authority. There's no statutory authority. And the board is set up based on, its authority is based in statute and in the Constitution, and our argument is that they can't go beyond that.
So any interpretation of that nature would be conducted, if at all, by a district court in a separate kind of action?
That's correct. That's correct. It's pure contract law. It's a disagreement there, and you're not dealing with the matters that they do have jurisdiction for. Okay. Are there any other questions or anything I can clear up? Okay. Thank you very much.
Let me turn to the jurisdiction issue because the court's raised it. The personnel board has full jurisdiction to hear it and interpret the contract. We've cited in briefs cases which says the board has very broad jurisdiction and its purpose is for protection of the state employees' rights. It's a well-established principle under Supreme Court termination that we cited in the briefs. The board has that right and should exercise that right, in our opinion, and that's why we originally filed with the board. Turning to Mr. Mosher's argument about the rights given to Ms. Kirkmeyer in the contract and what the limitations are, this has been cited to the court, but Board Rule 211C specifically provides concerning this, or has some control in this situation. It provides, as part of the negotiation process and consideration for a salary that exceeds the maximum, an employee entering the senior executive service may be required to waive certain rights. It's not mandatory that they waive under the board rules. So under the board rules itself, the board can determine what was waived and what was not waived because it's included in its own rules. That was the argument we made to the ALJ, that the waiver issue was before the ALJ. What was waived when my client entered the contract? What was the intent of the parties in entering the contract concerning the safe harbor provision?
Mr. Finger, can I ask you a procedural question as well?
Sure.
I hear your argument. Now, we heard that you made the same waiver argument in the other case we heard, the district court case. Why, if we were to agree with you that the issue of waiver should be litigated, why here as opposed to there? I'll be very candid with you. I am very concerned with the spillover between these two cases, and I'm trying to sort out myself who should hear what. And so, I mean, it seemed to me like the contract interpretation and the waiver issues were pretty well teed up in the district court case. So if we were to agree with you that there's an issue of waiver, why not the district court case versus this board case? How do you sort out what this board should hear and what the district court should hear, I guess is my question.
Well, let me go into the history of why we brought the lawsuit the way we did. What happened was that in late April, my client was told she was going to be separated from state service and that the contract would not be renewed. It was a verbal conversation testified to in the record. And my client then received a letter dated April 30th that she was going to be separated from the service. Exhibit C, which was a series of documents, showed that the separation decision was made on May 7th. So that was while she's still working. So she has protected rights. We brought the appeal at the State Personnel Board because of the issue of exhaustion of administrative remedies. We didn't want to jump into court and face that potential defense that we have an exhaustion issue. My perception is that the Personnel Board is the entity with primary jurisdiction because of the constitutional protections to state employees and the state system. So that's my perception. It is the State Personnel Board that has primary jurisdiction, and if the Personnel Board didn't have primary jurisdiction, then it belonged in district court.
I recognize your time's up, Mr. Freeman. Let me just ask you, so what would we do here? Would you say all this waiver issues and interpretation issues decided by the board, and then what do you do with the district court case?
What I think you should do is that you should enter an opinion saying my client has a right to a position under this. If we could prove there was a vacant position, and we did, and you ought to remand the matter back to the State Personnel Board with instructions that if the record shows that, then they formulate the appropriate remedy for relief for taking that right away from my client.
Judge,
you look so much alike.
One step for you have argued off and on that the intent of the parties, you've put in what would be extrinsic evidence under a traditional contract analysis. If we were to conclude that we can't do what you requested because the safe harbor clause in the contract in which it is embedded is ambiguous, should resolution of that ambiguity go back to the board?
My position is under the theories of primary jurisdiction and of an administrative body under a constitutional scheme, it should go back to the board. It's maybe simplistic, but that's my understanding of primary jurisdiction in a constitutionally created administrative agency, that they control that. But there is another issue that has to go to the district court, so you understand. We've made a claim for emotional upset and distress and other damages relating to this. The Personnel Board doesn't have jurisdiction over those issues. The jurisdiction of the board is a form of a make-whole remedy with wage loss or getting positions and things like that, and has no other court type of damage remedy.
Mr. Mosier, we've extended Mr. Finger's argument by several minutes. Would you wish to take a minute or two and address at least my question about ambiguity, and were we so to conclude whether that goes to the board or the district court, or if you said what you want to say?
Just to add that the last statement Mr. Finger said shows that it needs to go to the district court. I mean, there's other remedies here they're looking at involved with the contract that the board can't handle, that doesn't look at, doesn't have the authority.
Okay.
To.
Well, your position would be the ALJ got the scope of the remand right, the board should be affirmed, Mr. Finger still can argue, he may win, he may lose, ambiguity in the safe harbor clause, other remedies, but that argument belongs in the district court.
That's correct.
Thank you. That being the only case on our docket, we appreciate counsel's efforts. The case stands submitted. Written opinions in both cases will issue in due course simultaneously, and the bailiff may announce a recess.